Hi, it's Olivia Rosaman here, and I just wanted to let you know that to celebrate the Sydney Writers' Festival and all of the great minds that we have in town this weekend, we are releasing 4 special episodes in conversation with festival guests. You can find them all on your podcast player. Enjoy. It's Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Olivia Rosenman, and today we are speaking with Russian journalist Mikhail Zigor, who is in Sydney for the Sydney Writers' Festival. Mikhail Zigor has just published a new book, All the Kremlin's Men, an unprecedented insight into the inner workings of the Russian government and of Putin himself. Mikhail Zigor is a veteran Russian journalist, and he's also the founder of Project 1917 Free History, a website which documents the Russian Revolution using primary sources. Mikhail Zigor, welcome to Sydney, and thank you very much for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you for having me.
In your new book, you write that Putin began his presidency convinced that he could build good relations with the West, but that by his second term he'd turn against the West and become, in your words, a world-weary Slavophile philosopher. What brought him to this point?
Actually, during 3 terms of his presidency, he had a lot of attempts to become closer to the West. Initially, from the beginning, he wanted to make friends with his foreign partners like Tony Blair, whom he chose as his role model, and he wanted to look like Tony Blair a lot. Then he wanted to make friends with George W. Bush and wanted to be treated as an equal partner. And probably that was, in the beginning, the main factor of his disillusionment and disappointment. He didn't feel respected. He didn't feel that he was an equal partner, because actually, for George W. Bush, Russia was never a superpower, and to his point of view, he never wanted to consider Russia to be an equal partner to the United States. He, according to his advisors, in Bush's point of view, Russia was like another European country, big Finland or big Denmark, and that was not the point. Putin would feel flattering. There were a lot of different miscomprehensions. First, Putin even tried to get the invitation for Russia to join NATO, and that was his rather bold dream. Although in Russia, especially in those establishment circles, there are a lot of stereotypes and prejudice against NATO. But Putin asked ex-Secretary General, that time Secretary General of NATO, Lord Robertson, to invite Russia to that alliance. And he had an answer that, you know, we have a certain procedure. You have to fill in the application form and stand in line. And that was one of the moments when Putin felt a bit humiliated. He felt disrespected, and at the same time he felt his paranoia started growing. He could not believe that all those foreign leaders just underestimate Russia. If anybody explained to him that you know, George W. Bush thinks that Russia is a big Finland, he would never believed in that. And that's why he always thought that if those foreigners are so polite, but they act in a different way, they do not perform that manner he expected them to do, he thought that he might be cheated by them. They are not sincere. They are trying to create some conspiracy, probably. And that probably in the end of his first presidential term, he started believing in a lot of conspiracy theories. He started believing that there are some schemes, there is a plan to overthrow him. When he heard Bush doctrine that United States have to support democracies all over the world and to install new democratic regimes, he thought that they were talking about him. And actually that that was the end of his politics of rapprochement with the West.
You wrote the book based on interviews with Putin's inner circle. How willing were they to talk?
Actually, that was very hard. It took me 7 years to write the book, 7 years of those off-the-record interviews. First, in Russia, that's impossible to take on-record interviews with politicians if you want them to speak truthfully. That's just impossible. So from the very beginning, I warned that I was writing a book, that I shall now quote them directly, and only those phrases they agreed to be quoted I'll use for the book, and the majority of the interviews would be off the record. And then I had 7 years to convince many people to talk to me. Actually, I had my reputation as an independent journalist and as an editor-in-chief who was running the only independent news TV channel in Russia. For some, that was a good sign because they knew me as a decent journalist. For some, that was a minus because they were afraid of just approaching me. So some of them were curious. They of course knew the TV channel. They could not imagine they would ever give interview for that TV channel live. But that was kind of a challenge to look at me and to just to feel what is he, what he's about. I understood that all of them were lying, and that was the biggest challenge for me. Because everybody lies, and I had to compare all those hundreds of versions of truth. I had to read almost all the major Russian newspapers since 1999 till 2014, just to make a list of all the facts day by day, what was really happening, just to have a possibility to check when they are lying, when they are moving facts to different dates. So that was very long and very routine work to check what is true and what is not true.
I can't imagine for you personally that publishing this kind of book is entirely without risk in Russia. Were there any repercussions for you after having published the book?
Oh, you know, that was an adventure, I would say. Because initially, when I was looking for a publisher, and there was a couple of publishers willing to publish the book, we had a precondition that the publisher should have promised to publish the book within 6 months after we signed the contract, or to give the rights back to me, because there are cases in Russian book market when publishers sign the contracts with the authors and the book never appear. So I had to be very careful with that.
Why is that? Is it that the publisher is put under pressure to not publish the book, or is there some internal reason?
Yeah, probably some big publishers dependent on the state agencies, for example. There is an internal mess inside the publishers. One manager signs the contract, then after that the high general manager realizes that the book could be dangerous and it's better just to lose some little money but never risk the total business and the reputation of the publishing house. I was lucky to choose the really independent publisher. Not a very big company, but really independent. And at the same time, they had another very interesting precondition. There was a point in the contract that I should give them back my advance payment if all the copies of the book are arrested. They suspected that possibility could turn up. But after all, we were lucky. The book was published, and it is still being sold in all Moscow and Russian bookstores, and it became a bestseller. As much as 150,000 copies have been sold so far, and that's actually the best result for nonfiction in Russian history. And you know, I have no explanation why it was that successful. I know that some Russian officials, some top-level bureaucrats, were very disappointed with the book and were insulted by some paragraphs. At the same time, a lot of people including very top level state officials, publicly said this. Yeah, that's 80% true. Probably many people considered that book to be rather unbiased, and that's why it doesn't look like a propagandist book from neither side. It's not a book written by an opposition leader. It's not a book written by pro-Putin propagandists. So it's something in the middle.
Have you heard, has Putin commented on the book at all?
No, of course not. I've never heard anything about his reaction, and I suspect he never reads books. I know that his press secretary, Dmitry Peskov, has read it, and that was his phrase, that the book has got 80% of truth. That's an achievement for me, because a lot of journalists, my friends, told me that if Peskov says that 80% truth, that means 99%.
So in the past few months, we've seen The New Yorker allude to Russia's interference in U.S. politics with a cover portrait of Putin and the magazine's title in Russian. More recently, Time magazine's cover featured a mashup of the White House and Moscow's St. Basil's Cathedral. Do you think that this sort of outspoken coverage has any effect on the Russian leadership?
I've never seen anything so flattering to Vladimir Putin than this. You know, that's his dream came true. We started our conversation with President Putin's desire to be respected in the West. Now he's got that. I think he's happy. You haven't mentioned the CNN documentary called The Most Powerful Man in the World. I think it's all very impressive. I think that's great exaggeration. He is, of course, not that powerful. He is not controlling the White House. And that idealization of Vladimir Putin, that idea that he is a mastermind of a huge plan to conquer the world or to control America, that he controls Donald Trump, that's so untrue. But anyway, I'm more than sure that they are happy. He has achieved his dream to be a respected global leader. And then a lot of Russians love the fact that Russian president is so respected all over the world, that he has made Russia great again, that Russia is considered to be a superpower again. So that's even more effective than Russian state propaganda, I would suppose.
Have you watched House of Cards?
Yes, only first two seasons, but I watched less than Vladimir Putin, because he loves House of Cards, and that's his American politics textbook. He learns how American political system is working from that series.
What about the depiction of him, though, in that show? How truthful is it, do you think, or how well have they depicted him?
He's not the important character. The most important character is Frank Underwood, that evil American president. And Putin truly believes that that's how it works. He always recommends his freshly appointed ministers to watch all the series, because they need to know how it works. They need to see the face of the enemy. He has always thought that all those talks about morals, about values in American or European politics, that's all hypocrisy. And that every time he is lectured about human rights or about liberal values, he's being cheated. He never trusted Barack Obama or Angela Merkel. And but before, he had no proof, or at least something he considered to be proofs, but mostly that was his inner prejudice. But that film is a smoking gun for him. Now at least he knows that everything he has been suspecting was right.
So you mentioned the CNN documentary and said that to consider Putin as the most powerful man in the world. That was a bit of an exaggerated statement. But I just want to ask more generally, how good or bad a job do you think the English-speaking media does of covering Russia and Russian politics?
I think that's not the best service for American society, because that's, to my mind, much more a manipulation with some fears and stereotypes. And, you know, that reminds me a lot of those conspiracy theories I've been watching on Russian TV channels for many years. because Russian stereotypical portrayal of American foreign policy is that there is anti-Russian conspiracy initiated by CIA, and CIA and Pentagon are trying to dismantle Russia and to ruin the state, to divide it into several regions, to take Siberia, and so on and so on. And everything what happens is part of that global conspiracy. The revolution in Ukraine is a part of America's attempt to overthrow Putin's regime. An anti-corruption investigation in FIFA, in soccer, is a part of that plot to take future 2017 World Cup from Russia. So it's very sophisticated conspiracy theory. And when I watch all those documentaries and all those news in American media, I think that's the same. You just need to change the word CIA for word Putin, and now you've got a huge conspiracy initiated by Putin against America and Europe. He's trying to install his puppets. He's trying to affect the outcome of the elections. That's a huge conspiracy theory, and that's a mistake.
So you don't think that there's any truth to the allegations of Russian interference in the election?
You know, I don't think that that idea that there was a strategy is right. Putin is not a strategic player. He doesn't have a plan. He's done a lot of different things. Every time that was a reaction. He's a tactical player, not a strategical.
So you said on Monday night on Q&A that everyone knows that going into politics in Russia means risking your life, your freedom, your family, your reputation, and your money. That's a pretty depressing prospect for young people in Russia. What would it take to restore a functioning political system?
Oh, that's the most serious question I don't know answer for. You know, we've got a problem. So-called Russian stability is the major factor of our instability, because we don't have real institutions. And for many Russians, Putin is considered to be the most important factor of the stability. He believes that he is the only man to save the country. People are scared of asking question, what is going to happen after him? We've got no political process. We've got no politicians except for one opposition leader whose name is Alexei Navalny. Everybody is afraid of taking part in any independent political movements. They have seen a lot of examples how independent politicians on local level, on regional level, on national level were persecuted, were imprisoned. And just a lot of tragic stories happened during the last years. I see no way out so far. Next year, we're going to have the new presidential election. Probably Putin is going to run for his fourth term, and he's going to win. There is no alternative candidate. Even Alexei Navalny, the only opposition candidate who could turn up during that electoral campaign. And we don't know for sure if he's going to be allowed to run or not. But anyway, even if he runs against Putin, he's got no chances of winning. But that's okay. The most important question, what happens next when Putin is out of power? When he runs out of batteries? We're going to have no institutions, no political leaders, and no political culture to be a substitute for that current political system. And I think that's the most scary challenge we face.
Russia ranks 148th of 180 countries on the World Press Freedom Index. Reporters Without Borders describes it as an oppressive environment for those who try to maintain quality journalism. State-owned media bombard the population with propaganda, and most independent media have either been brought into line or harassed out of existence. What is it like working as a journalist in Russia?
First, I need to say a couple of words in favor of independent journalism in Russia, because it exists. I think the fact that my book has been published in Russia and is being sold in Russia, that's kind of proof that some level of freedom of speech is still there. There are some independent media, and that's very difficult to survive. Actually, our TV channel, TV Rain, was very successful independent news TV channel from 2010 to 2014, actually for only 4 years. And then we became a victim of coordinated attack. That was a huge smear campaign with a lot of people accusing us of some hypothetical crimes. We were blamed to insult the memories of those fallen during the Second World War and so on and so on, to be pro-Nazi and pro-fascists and traitors and so on and so on. As a result, all the major cable and satellite networks switched us off, and we lost 90% of the audience. That was not the initiative, actually, of those cable operators. They had direct phone calls from Kremlin, and they were demanded to drop us. So that was really painful campaign against the independent TV channel. And so that TV channel still exists, but now it's much more just an online TV channel with 60,000 viewers monthly, not 20 million as we used to have 3 years ago. So it's difficult, but at the same time, it's more or less possible. It's not actually dangerous to be an independent journalist in Russia. You risk your job. You can lose your job if you're a bald guy. Your newspaper or your website could suffer problems, economical problems. Mostly you are not risking your life unless you have problems with really dangerous guys like Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov, who's got the reputation of a scary person. A lot of journalists were attacked, or some of them even killed, coincidentally, after writing investigative reports about situation in Chechnya. And the second thing I must add, that it looks like Russia is rather progressive country in terms of social media and social journalism. All the mainstream paper media is dead. That's a global trend. But in Russia, there are political reasons for that trend, not only economical as elsewhere in the world. In many other countries in the world, the mainstream paper media are going to be dead within a decade. And in Russia, it has already happened. The new age of the digital media has already started in Russia, because it's very difficult and very expensive to print a newspaper or to have a proper TV channel. It's very cheap and efficient to have your own video blog on YouTube, to have your private news investigative website, and we've got a lot of that. Actually, we have a lot of people who are not supposed to be journalists to make that job journalists usually do. Charity foundations, some volunteer organizations conduct real investigative reports. That's really important for journalism and for civil society in the country.
Can you tell us a bit about Project 1917 Free History and why you wanted to create a project like that? And who is the audience that you intended it for?
You know, initially, after quitting TV Rain, I felt that I'm a bit tired with that news agenda. I don't want to produce the news about Putin's regime on a daily basis, because nothing changes and nothing is happening. But at the same time, I decided to cover, as media, really important events, but which are not happening now. And that's why we started Project 1917, that looks like actually a social media, as if internet existed 100 years ago, and as if in the year 1917, all the main characters could have an access to internet and could write their diaries, post them online. That's a documentary project. We've collected all the diaries of all the worldwide celebrities, Russians and not only Russians. It's mainly focused on Russian Revolution of that year, but not only. We've got Albert Einstein and Franz Kafka, the First World War, Russian Valley, Pablo Picasso. So more than 2,000 characters acting and writing on a daily basis. So every day you can watch and you can read what is happening this day exactly 100 years ago. that looks like a series, but not TV series, but much more text series. That's online drama, actually, but documentary drama. And I consider it to be like the new genre of learning history, of teaching history, probably, of telling the story about the past. That's much more an educational project, because I think that in today's Russia, that's very important, not only to give people information about what's happening today, but also to give them a background information about the past, because first, history is usually used as an instrument in Russian propaganda. And when current propaganda is trying to prove that Russia is an empire and has always been an empire, and that's we should be proud of. Probably it's possible, and that's needed to show another perspective, to show the history of Russian civil society that has a great and very impressive history of fighting for freedom. Actually, 1917 is a very important year for Russian civil society. That was a year when Russia became the first country in the world to ban death penalty. That was one of the first European countries to give women voting rights. That was very progressive for that period. Many major countries like France, United Kingdom, or United States made that quite later, quite a bit later. That part of history is not known in Russia and abroad as well, because a lot of people in the world have certain stereotypes about Russian Revolution. It seems for many that Vladimir Lenin was the main character, and he was the man who toppled the last Russian Emperor Nicholas II. That's not true, and I think that's very important for first. That's very important for some kind of self-consciousness of the nation. And especially that's important for young people. And mainly the main idea of that project is to show some broader perspective and to get rid of some stereotypes, especially among young people, because for them, this format is much more readable. They get used to that format. They do not consider it as reading when they have their iPhone and get the information from social networks. They're just scrolling, and that's the way they consume all the information. The project is very popular in Russia. It's probably the one and only popular historical project. We've got a lot of young people watching it daily, and we've got a lot of feedback from abroad as well. Initially, we didn't plan to start an English version, and we have it from January. So project1917.com, that's working project, and that's a unique collection of all the diaries of Russian Revolution. But at the same time, that's the completely new genre of online literature.
All right, and I would recommend everyone check it out. It's fascinating.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you. My name's Olivia Rosenman. Thank you for listening to Fourth Estate. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, and please leave us a review on iTunes or whichever podcast player you are using. Stay in touch on Facebook and Twitter, and do let us know if there are any topics you'd like us to cover. Catch you next week.